And tonight, our special guest on Coast to Coast, physicist James McCanney. We're going to talk about some Planet X objects. We're going to talk about stardust. And we're going to talk about some other issues that Professor Canny has right here on Coast to Coast AM. Master of Science Professor James McCanney, a physicist. He has spent decades promoting his theoretical work showing that the solar system is ever-changing, electrically active. These theories have been confirmed with space probe data and prove that there are definite Earth effects resulting from our sun's electrical activity. He has openly opposed NASA's view that outer space is electrically neutral. McCanney was a faculty member of the physics and mathematics departments of Cornell University in Ithaca, New York, and he has researched theoretical celestial mechanics and plasma physics. Those are the studies of planetary motion and electrified gases in outer space, and has also presented theories at the Los Alamos National Laboratories and the American Geophysical Union. He is our guest here on Coast to Coast. Hey, James, how are you?
George, good evening.
My pleasure. And I'm not going to let you get away tonight without talking about what the sun might be doing to Earth changes on this planet, too, because I have a feeling, James, we've just seen the tip of the iceberg, so to speak, if it doesn't all melt.
Right, exactly. So, yes, we will talk about that.
What have you been up to lately? We haven't talked to you for a while. You know, we did that brief roundtable discussion with you in October, but I haven't talked in depth with you in a while. What's up with you?
Well, I've been busy. I don't know what I've been doing. I've actually kind of streamlined most of my projects and am working on them simultaneously. And I just got back from a little trip where I was looking into electric fields above Earth and some of my ongoing work in that area. So that's I just got back from that a little while ago.
We've coined a phrase for you, a maverick physicist. How do you like that phrase? Is that appropriate for you?
I guess kind of being a wild guy is that's okay. I like that.
Well, you know, I mean, you do go against the conventional, you know, methods of science a lot of times. You have your own theories. But some of them now are beginning to say, you know what, this McCanney might not be wrong. How do you feel when they begin to at least say to you, you know what, years ago we would have thought you were off your rocker, not anymore?
Well, one of the biggest confirmations of that are if you look at the American Geophysical Union meetings, everything there is dealing with electric fields, vertical electric fields. NASA just began a program measuring electric fields above hurricanes and had some amazing success with some of the recent hurricanes and are now amazed at their own results. I believe everything I've been talking about is being confirmed.
You know, because of you, I went and got the old book, Worlds in Collision, by Velikovsky.
Oh.
And fascinating, fascinating work. It is too bad that this individual during his day, that he was treated the way he was.
You know, and I just talked with, just as long as we're on this topic, I did a brief interview with a guy named Warner Sizemore, who was Velikovsky's right-hand man for 25 years. And I know Warner decades ago because he was the executive editor of Kronos, which was a journal I had some of my comet articles published in. But be that as it may, he talked about Velikovsky the man, and, you know, we should get him on Coast to Coast one night.
I'd love to, the two of you. That would be historical for us.
Yeah, and he just knew him, and that's the one thing he said, is Velikovsky was a gentleman, he was honorable, he was a scholar, he was educated in the traditional conservative European style, and the reaction he got here was really uncalled for.
Was he a genius, Jim?
He was so far ahead of his time that was his biggest problem. And when he was labeled, now that label is carried along with him. And unfortunately, as Velikovsky himself said near the end of his life, he said one of his biggest problems was sometimes the entourage of people that gathered around him and were, you know, making a lot of noise and very much unlike him. And so he was labeled sometimes because of the people that gathered around him. Not Warner Sizemore, but just other people. And I was witness to some of that myself. But anyway, no, Belikovsky was just a gentleman. I have on the new CD that I've posted a 10-minute clip of him giving a lecture at Brown University. And you can tell when he talks that he's just very reserved, very scholarly. He has that thick European accent. And so I know people are going to be interested in actually hearing him speak because that's something that just is not available.
Oh, no, not at all. Yeah, and definitely get with Lisa and let's set something up because,
okay.
For people who aren't aware of Velikovsky's theories, he believes that Venus was captured, about 5,000 years ago, something like that,
well,
James?
Well, the dates he gave were, this is in 1950, so he said 3,650 years before that. And he said he was talking about calendars, and his whole study was dealing with chronology of history, which most people don't understand. But the dates, those were the dates he picked. And he also knew that some of those dates may be off, but there was a very radical change in calendars all around the world at that time. And he was looking for an event that was worldwide in scope, and he found what I call the Venus event, or Velikovskians call the Venus event, where Venus came somehow by Jupiter, out of Jupiter, that's what the mythology says, and came through the solar system. It stripped Mars of its atmosphere and oceans. The people saw that, and that's why Mars is such an enigma today. And then it passed by Earth twice in a 54-year interval, and we know that according to the Mayans. But then Venus finally nestled into its orbit, and the science of the time and even the science of today, this is totally contrary to what they believe. And we'll talk some about comets and the Stardust issue and Deep Impact tonight. But the bottom line is scientists are just flat wrong about how the solar system works, about how it formed, what comets are, that there can be giant comets. And historically, there's so many records of giant comets we don't see today. But basically, he was seeing this through the eyes of the ancient texts. And then he saw all the devastation around Earth, the geological record, the mastodons in Siberia. He's the one that made that issue famous.
That's the one that had the vegetation still in its mouth?
Yeah, yeah. Things just totally unexplainable by normal means. And so he gathered this huge amount of information, and, of course, it went against every vein of academia. So they got together, and they really buried him both physically and kind of psychologically in the mind of the American public and the world public.
Well, what's so ironic now, James, is that, by the way, when I called you Jim earlier, my staff said I sounded like Bones from Star Trek talking to Captain Kirk. Tell
Either
me
way,
more,
that's
Jim. but you know, scientists last week said that they believe Mercury collided with a huge object, and it just chopped off part of its crust. We know that the Earth collided with another huge object, creating the moon, and you know the other one turned into little pieces. There were worlds in collision. And Velikovsky saw that, yet science didn't recognize it. They won't recognize it yet, but they're talking about these collisions now in the solar system.
Right. They just came out with Pluto. They said that's the way Charon, Pluto's biggest moon, must have formed. But they always put it millions or billions of years ago, out of sight, out of mind. And that's where one of the topics I talk about, the many Planet X objects. The whole idea is that our telescopes just don't reach out there that far. And I have some quotes here from various astronomers that say that it's going to be 10 to 15 years till we get big telescopes out towards the edge of the solar system before we're going to really be able to see what's out there. So how can astronomers talk about or say conclusively there's nothing out there. There's no such thing as a 10th planet when there's ample evidence that there is. NASA had its own program. It was called the Search for Planet X, and Harrington at the Naval Observatory ran the program for, you know, a dozen years. A
couple years ago, 2003, couple people truly talked about Planet X coming into our solar system, creating all kinds of havoc. Of course, Nancy Leader, as she claims she talks through the Zetas, and then Mark Hazelwood would do his research talking about this Planet X object. Now, at that time, I think the mistake they both made was trying to pinpoint a date. I think had they mentioned that we believe that there's an object out there, a huge planet somewhere, we think it comes around, Sitchin believes, every 3,600 years. So there's a lot of people out there, James, that believe that there's a huge object out there, maybe more than one. I think the problem is that when you set these dates, whether they believe it or not, and then the dates come and nothing happens, their credibility goes out the window. Why don't they, rather than come up with that specific date, sit back, analyze, and say a lot of the things that you've done in your career without giving you a timetable? I mean, I remember Nancy was talking about May of 2003. I mean, you talk about pinpointing a date. Why do they do that?
Well, there again, my personal feeling on that one is that that was a programmed misinformation ploy to discredit the whole idea of Planet X. It's a very subtle ploy, but excuse me, that was my belief on that.
Do you think they were part of the ploy?
No.
Or they were being fed misinformation or what?
No, Mark Hazelwood, I know, has changed considerably since that time and understands the issue of dating, that type of thing. But the whole idea of picking a date like May 15th, and it turned out to be that was a night when there was a huge orange full moon coming up over the west coast of California.
Mm-hmm. I remember that. That's
a little
right.
bit too
yeah.
ironic for my taste. So at any rate, but on your question about picking dates, I don't pick dates unless I have a reason to. And I did weekly analysis of these areas that they were talking about, and I saw nothing, and I told people I saw nothing. So, that was a very trying time for all of us because, you know, it finally came and went, thank goodness. But I think the idea of Planet X, that there's something out there, has actually maintained and grown more acceptance, even though some people may have gone by the wayside.
Well, you know, I've interviewed astronomers, Philip Plate, Seth Shostak, who's with SETI, and, I've tried to pin them down on whether they believe there's a Planet X in the solar system, that we just haven't spotted it yet. And they, you know what, they don't directly say no. They say it's possible, but they believe astronomers would have seen it by now. But it's interesting the way they kind of tempered that question. Now, Plate, of course, debated Nancy Leader during that May period of 2003. He was absolutely correct in the way he made his presentation at the point. But they don't deny that there might be something out there somewhere that just hasn't been found. They don't think so, but they don't, deny it.
Right. I've got a quote here that's from an article. This came out of New Scientist. And let me just read this. It says, this is by Alan Stern, who's an astronomer with Southwest Research Institute in Boulder. It says, the evidence for the existence of Planet X is compelling, but although calculations show that such a body could account for the Kuiper Cliff, no one has ever seen this fabled 10th planet. The Kuiper Cliff is kind of the cutoff region where you see no more of the small planet Pluto-type objects out there. And then he goes on, he says, there's a good reason for that. The Kuiper Belt is just too far away for us to get a decent view. We need to get out there and have a look before we can say anything about the region. And that won't be possible for another decade at least. NASA's New Horizons probe, which will head out to Pluto and the Kuiper Belt, is scheduled for launch in 2006. It won't reach Pluto until 2015. So if you're looking for an explanation of the vast empty gulf of the Kuiper Cliff, watch this space. But what if they send a telescope out there and the big guy is out in the other direction?
Yeah.
I mean, we are just this. I think this guy hit the nail on the head and is really, and he's with Southwest Research, which is a bit different. That's more of a government think tank than, say, astronomers who work for a university or, say, have more communication with the public.
Well, you know, they're out there. I mean, you've got John Lear, who's got more credentials than the size of my arm, who believes that the moon was towed into position, that there was no collision at all. So it's fascinating how people who have had tremendous amounts of experience and expertise in their own areas come up with these different theories that I find to be just fascinating.
Well, I'm the capture theory proponent. And the way it works is that these objects come in, the capture process is well known. You need a twin body gravitational field to attract and capture them and cause the energy reduction. And then the comet tail, which is part of the process, further reduces the energy of the object and it becomes trapped. Just like our moon could have been. I've always said that the moon could have been here first and Earth came second.
All right, I'm not going to pin you down on a date after everything I've just said, but I'm going to ask you, Jim, if you think there is that planet X size object in our solar system and where it might be.
Well, my whole story is that, and of course, I don't have the good equipment. I wish I did, but I believe there are many, many of these. And that we have no information on and could not possibly have information on, and that they might come back every million years or 300,000 years. We simply don't have the astronomical data or equipment to detect these objects and pinpoint their orbits. And a lot of the bigger ones have entourages of objects around them. Something like a mini solar system, and the ancients actually talk about this, where they have multiple comets, big comets in the solar system at one time, the kind of comets that we have never seen in modern times and that modern astronomers deny because we've never seen them. Hale-Bopp was kind of on that scale, kind of a small to medium-sized comet. These are big comets, and that's the whole issue, that comets are not dirty snowballs. They are a plasma discharge of our solar capacitor, and anything that comes into the solar system is going to form that comet tail until it circularizes its orbit or leaves.
Do you still fear that we're going to get swept by a comet tail or, you know, the object itself?
Well, action at a distance is much more probable than a direct collision, but we've seen cases where comets come by the sun, kick out a big flare. A lot of times those flares have not hit us, but if we were in that direction, we could definitely be affected.
I want to get your take when we come back from the break, James. We've got all night with you tonight to talk about all these things, stardust, deep impact. I want to get your take on Zechariah Sitchin's theories, too.
Okay.
And I've never asked you about that. Tell us about your website, Mr. McCanny. What's new on it?
Well, of course, the CD, which has the four-part lectures, The Science of the Many Planet X Objects, and that CD also includes the Christmas interview I did with Warner Sizemore, friend of Velikovsky, and a 10-minute clip of Velikovsky, and another lecture on the mega tsunamis, along with pictures.
So. Mr. McCanny's website is linked up at coasttocoastam.com. When we come right back, let's get his take on Zechariah Sitchin, and then we'll get into Stardust, Deep Impact, and lo and behold, sometime tonight we'll open up the phone lines for you. I'm George Norrie. We'll be back in a moment at Coast to Coast AM. All right, we're back with physicist and professor James McCanny. James, a long time ago, Zechariah Sitchin came up with his own theories on the Sumerian texts and tablets. Pretty astounding. I remember years ago reading his 12th Planet and his theories and the direction that he was trying to take this. And it was, to me, pretty mind-boggling. What about you?
Well, he obviously fell into the same mode of research as Velikovsky, and a lot of times there's mixing and misunderstanding of the two. And so when I talk, you want to know about what my opinion of Sitchin was. And then my own studying very early on when I was reading Velikovsky and I had already worked on my theoretical work, it became apparent to me that there was, back in the old days when this activity was going on and Earth was being affected and people were writing about it, and these texts have come down to us in many forms, it was clear to me that there was more than one object in the sky at one time, and it was very clear to me that Velikovsky was right, that they were in the form of comets. And so with that in mind, now when, say, some type of object, a Planet X object, comes in, and I'm just speaking in the generic term,
okay,
now, it would, if it's big, it's going to have things around it. It's going to be, and that's what fooled astronomers when Hale-Bopp came in. It had a companion, and
it brings company with it, doesn't it?
It brings company, and definitely, if it's big, it's going to have objects orbiting it. And when they come in, they're going to look as multiple comets coming in. And I just pulled out over the break a little passage here, which came out of the Colbrin, which is a collection of old texts. It's talking about the says it is known from the story, comes down from the ancient times, that there was not one creation but two. It's talking about the destruction of Earth, and it says, at the time of the great destruction of Earth, God caused a dragon from out of heaven to come and encompass her about. And it goes on talking about all of the effects and the lightning and the thick fog. But then it goes on and it says, the first sky monster was joined by another, which swallowed the tail of the one going before. And it talks about...
Sounds like comets, doesn't it?
It talks about the two comets interacting.
Yeah.
And so...
Maybe they even collided together. What do you think?
Well, yeah. And there's a mystery as to what happened to the companion of Hale-Bopp. And my belief is that it just finally orbited into the main nucleus and became part of the main nucleus.
You know, here's a question about this, since you bring up this story. How did the writers of the Colbrin know this? I mean, who told them?
Well, the history of the Colbrin, the Colbrin book itself that we see today, the one with the big purple cover with the Celtic insignia on the front.
It's huge.
Is right. It's now, this book was put together in 1994. By a group of women who I have been in communication with. But prior to that, it was only in the form of scraps and parts of texts, which were handed down literally through thousands of years. So one of the misnomers is that the Colbrin is somehow a book that came down through ancient times. The Colbrin really means library.
So it was in pieces, and it was then assembled, maybe?
It was assembled and finally put out, and I got one of the very early distribution of this. There were three that came into the country, and all of these were accounted for. They only printed 900 of them, and I got one of the first three in the United States. And there's so much misinformation now revolving around this book that it's incredible, but the Colbrin as such did not exist before 1994. Just the library, and one of the unfortunate things is the vast library that sits behind the Colbrin probably will never surface now because of the kind of thievery that's gone on over this book in the past couple years. But the point is that the Colbrin has... documents that really come from the time thousands of years before Christ, and that literally came from a library that was held by Joseph of Arimathea. He took it to England after Christ's death, and it was housed eventually at the bigger abbey that was built at Glastonbury until the Roman army went in and literally was sent in to destroy it. They got word of this in the middle of the night, and they got some of the books out, and then after the destruction of the abbey, they went back and picked up the pieces. So literally, that was taken underground at that time and held by the Chaldeans, who held it until into the time when this was finally put together. So the history of the Colburn has really been distorted and altered, unfortunately, but that is the true history. In the Colburn book that you hold in your hand today, that big, beautiful book, was only put together in the early 90s and finally printed in very limited edition and then copyrighted in 1994.
All right, but pretty dramatic information in there, James.
Oh, absolutely. But see, you have to understand from the reason they gave me the book is because of my scientific work, and they said, can you tell us what this means? Because these people, their instructions all the way down through the thousands of years that this came down was to preserve the purity of that original text.
Why was everything in images? I mean, why do they talk about the dragon in the sky gobbling up the tail when you can interpret it, and so many other people can? It's obvious that it's some kind of series of celestial objects up there.
Right.
Why don't they simply say, object up there in the sky that I get, because they didn't know what they were? Is that why?
Well, of course, yeah. And even look up to the time of Kepler, Aristotelian belief was that comets were fire in the atmosphere. And it was only up to when Kepler took measurements and realized that these were in orbit far from Earth out around the sun that they began to realize that these were not part of Earth or in our own atmosphere. So these people were just writing down what they saw. Like here are some of the other passages. It says, its passage caused great thunderings and lightnings to render the thick, darkened sky, all heaven and earth being made hot. The seas were loosened from their cradles and rose up, pouring across the land. There was awful shrilling trumpeting, which outpowered even the howling of the unleashed winds. So those are they're talking about what they saw and observed, and they interpreted this as God punishing man for not correcting his evil ways.
All right, so we know, though, there was an event. Do we know when this particular one might have happened?
Now, there again, the Colburn is just talking about the ancient days, and it does not give a date. And there's no way of dating, and that's one of the things that Velikovsky said about, was locating the dates when this happened, because let's take the Mayan calendar, of which there's, once again, a huge amount of misinformation. It took hundreds and hundreds of years for the Mayan calendar to stabilize back in the old days. When people study the Mayans today, they think about the classic and the post-classic period in, 800 A.D. But the reality is these people were associated or derived from a group of people that we don't know much about at all. And that was back in the 1600 to 1800 B.C. era when all the calendars changed. So all of this happened. We know that Venus had two passages of Earth, and there were probably more, because you find that throughout the ancient texts they talk about this. When Solon went back to Egypt from early Greece, the Greek cults, the priest cults, said that this had happened 10 times in the past 10,000 years.
10 times?
Five times, I'm sorry, in the past 10,000 years.
Right. Well, that's still five times too many, Jim.
So, and this is my belief, is that there are probably many of these objects out there we know nothing about. And so people talk about Planet X. I talk about the many Planet X objects.
As if we have enough to worry about with real Earth changes, incredible weather patterns, man-made disasters, the possibility of, nuclear problems down the line. That's all we need is for an object to come rolling this way as well. It probably will come as a surprise, though, won't it? I mean, will it just appear?
How much
leeway will we have?
That's what the ancients talk about also, that they come unexpected, and they very rarely are expecting them. The thing that's very clear about the Venus event, the first one was probably not as damaging as the second one.
Of course, they didn't have the technology then that we have now. So when they say unexpected, if they couldn't see it, let's say, with a naked eye,
right,
they never knew it was coming.
Well, the supposedly Venus, the best I can read out of it, it came out of the sun. In other words, the comet came around the sun and directly at Earth. from the sunward
side.
Right,
so you can't see it back.
They really couldn't see it coming, and all of a sudden there it was, and the other shoe dropped. But the scenario I linked with Sitchin's work and Velikovsky is, this is kind of what I pieced together, although once again I wouldn't bet a lot on dates. And this is based on just one other little caveat. When I was doing my early celestial mechanics work, I made an estimate of the time it would take Venus to migrate from Jupiter and orbit out by Jupiter in towards Earth using tail drag.
Mm-hmm.
And it took about 600 years.
600 years. Well, we've got a space probe that we're trying to get up there that'll take 9 years. That's pretty fast.
Right. But if, say that this was captured by Jupiter and the ancients sat there and watched this thing for a period of 600 years, and all of a sudden...
Getting closer and bigger and things
bigger
like that.
And that's why you have Quetzalcoatl, the very early Peruvians,
yes.
the Aztecs. Every culture there is centered about that comet that became Venus. And that's what modern astronomers, modern archaeologists don't understand. I was in Chichen Itza. I've done surveying there. It doesn't sit northeast, south, and west. It sits in points towards the old North Pole, which is just north of Michigan.
If 10 was very accurate and 1 was poor, where would you put Zachariah Sitchin's theories on that scale? If 1 was just very lousy and 10 was a very accurate prediction and interpretation,
I would put it at about an 8.5.
That's pretty high.
That's because I don't pick dates. Excuse me, and I think it's very difficult to pick dates.
Would that include his theory of extraterrestrial visitation, or do you rule that out?
There again, I'm somewhat neutral on that, although my own personal belief is that I believe there are civilizations out there fully capable of coming to this solar system, and this is kind of a little oasis out in the edge of the galaxy. And I would almost find it surprising that spacefaring entities have not been here in the past.
So you would say that Sitchin, in that regard, was pretty high too, an 8.5?
Somewhere above 5.
5.
I would say.
On the ET part.
Right, yeah. And the situation, I work in one of my other little areas is deals with electromagnetic propulsion systems. I did a whole series on what I call electric rivers to the stars, in that we're not going to get to the stars with nuclear engines or impulse engines or inertial-type engines where you have to heat something up and spit it out. And as a result, I realized there are electric currents that flow through the universe, and those you can see and measure, and you can ride along those electric currents with a passive electric propulsion system. I call it an electric kite. It's a very subtle concept. But and I also have a propulsion system that's based on fusion engines, which is an active propulsion system, but it doesn't expel material. And so the point is there are ways to get around the galaxy, not inertial engines, but kind of like sailing, so to speak. It's a free trip once you design the spacecraft that uses this propulsion system. So we're at the kind of old square rig sailing rig compared to the 747 jetliner in our space travel.
Probably. A couple minutes ago for this segment, James, and then we'll come back and talk about the Stardust and some other issues at hand that are going on in the planet. Have you ever met Zachariah Sitchin? I bet you would like to. You two would probably hit it off.
Yeah, we've communicated just by letter. And, of course, he uses a typewriter, which is interesting, and then signs it. And no, we've not met, and there was some things that were going on where he was going to be someplace, and then I couldn't be there, and I don't know. So it just has not.
Are you convinced that sometime this planet is going to get hit by or swept by some kind of object?
It's a let's put it this way. It has in the past. It's going to happen in the future. And that's why I say that what we have to learn is that we are spending all of our time and resources in absolutely the wrong direction. We should be spending just about all of our time becoming spacefaring as a large population, not sending a guy to the moon in 15 years. I'm talking about, and I firmly believe the Chinese will be there way before us. They're going to have large populations in space and populating. The only way you can survive one of these events, let's put it this way, is to have large groups of populations of space cities that are all over the solar system. And if one of these events happen where a big entourage comes through the solar system, some of those will survive.
You do it almost like a space capsule. It's like this seed bank they're talking about, where they want to put every seed they can find in there, at least for food purposes, when they have to grow crops again. You would do the same thing with people.
Well, and maybe a half a million people in a space city, you know, and put them all over the solar system, and that's the only way that our species could survive one of these major.
Do we have the technology, Jim, to build one of these things?
Actually, yes. And that's something I've been working on. I talked about building the space wheels, much like the 2001 type of space wheel. And the way you spirit them away from Earth is the central axis. You put a conductor down there. You actually discharge one of the local electric batteries around Earth, and it moves away in the Earth's magnetic field. It's an electromagnetic propulsion system, and you can spin these things out. The containers themselves are just large tubes. We could make those out of composites and just start lifting them off with nuclear-based water rockets.
Would you have given the chance, if you knew there was an incoming object and the planet was going to get wiped out, and that, let's say, 100,000 people could go to this space city, would you volunteer to go and live up there in that kind of environment for the rest of your life, or would you stay on the planet and take the hit?
I'd have to think about that one. I'm not a big person for going into space myself.
All right, well, think about that, because let's talk about the space city when we come back and some other things as well. I'm George Norrie with Professor James McCanny on Coast to Coast AM. All right, Jim, I gave you a full 10 minutes to decide if you're going to go up in space or not.
I think I would. When I saw that thing heading this way, it would be kind of like, you know, a rabbit running from the.
You would go. Would you go with the idea of coming back to the planet, or to live forever in space until you passed on?
Well, if it were that devastating, it might be a while till you could actually come back and plant a garden. But the Earth has gone through this many times and recovered. So I believe the idea would be to preserve the species, so to speak, and that would be the long-term goal, which I believe is real different than our current space program, which is to try and get a man to the moon or, you know, something like that. It's a totally different concept where you have to literally live in space. You can't come back to Earth for supplies. Or a resupply ship. You have to learn to live out there, grow your food, recycle your all the oxygen and the CO2, the wastewater, whatever it is, has to be recycled. It has to be the bionic living system, the biosphere, so to speak.
Well, let's say if this city in space were to hold, let's say, just 100,000 people. Maybe 144,000. explain what it would look like.
Well, to understand what it would look like, you have to understand how to get the pieces up there.
All right.
And back in the 70s, the Russians developed a rocket. And remember when you were a kid and you hooked up these little water rockets to the garden hose and they would shoot up a couple hundred
feet? Yeah, I loved them.
And there's a way to do that. They're called steam rockets. They're nuclear-powered. You build a casing, and these casings would be about 200 feet long, 30 feet in diameter, a carbon fiber-wound cylinder, basically, with round ends. And basically, it would look like an inverted Diet Coke 2-liter bottle, one of those plastic.
Yeah. Okay.
And but big, long, and 30-foot diameter, 200 feet long. And the way the rocket works is you put a nuclear cell in and fill it up, you know, two-thirds of the way with water, and the cell basically converts the water to steam. And then you have a tube that runs from the top, and basically you're using the steam, extremely hot steam, as the propulsion mechanism. It's the same exact situation as the liquid oxygen, liquid hydrogen engine, except you're just getting that water propelled by a different mechanism. It's very simple and very effective, and you can put these tubes then into orbit, hundreds of them, and you would bundle them together in groups of seven, just like if you took a nickel and put it on the table and you could put six nickels around it. That would be the configuration. So now you have seven of these 200 feet long, and you start stringing these together like sausages, so to speak. And then you put stays in the middle, and you start this spinning, and it looks like a bicycle tire. And you have hundreds of these connected, these seven tiered tubes connected together. And then, similar to the bicycle wheel concept, where the axle of the wheel goes, you put a long tube, and that's your propulsion system. You direct that vertically away from the Earth, and you discharge the local electric field there. The current passing through that tube then pushes against the Earth's magnetic field, and it ferries you out into outer space. So you start launching these and building these rotating cities, and they then move out into space, and then by the same mechanism, discharging the solar capacitor, they then would push against the very faint magnetic field that's in outer space, free outer space away from Earth, and these then would slowly move out into the solar system. And you would position these, as I said, all over the place so that when something came through, now you have to understand if a big comet comes through, some of these are going to get damaged or destroyed.
Right. Now, how big would this be compared to the International Space Station, obviously?
Oh,
huge, right?
You could put the space station in the corner of one of these tubes.
Okay.
So this is huge. And the way you take it up is in pieces. And, of course, anything that goes mechanically into space is constructing it up there is the doing it repetition is the key, I guess that's the term that I should use. But building the space cities then would become routine, and instead of building SUVs and gas guzzling, you know, using our oil for that, you use the oil to start building these space cities. And we convert Earth, if there were time, into a green Earth where we live on the environment and with the environment, so to speak, where, say, people have gardens in their yards, et cetera. But if one of these catastrophic events were to happen, then this would be just one way. And I imagine there would be people who would want to go into space and live like that. Not you, and I would question myself, but there are probably people who would want to do that.
Well, it's pretty exciting for some. Not for me.
I'm kind of with you. I like my feet old down here on old terra firma. But I think the newer generations might become interested in that. But we literally have to do this if the – because eventually, I don't know if it's 1,000 years or 10,000 years, one of these is going to – events is going to happen again. And they come from outer space. And it's just a game of, in a sense, Russian roulette. Maybe we'll survive the next one. Maybe the next one won't be very bad. Remember that if we were 3 months earlier in our orbit, we would have had a major league encounter with Hale-Bopp, and we would have been in its coma.
Oh, yeah.
For about 20 days. Just think of the lack of sunlight, the influx of water from the tail, other potential conditions. Earth would not be the same right now.
Oh, we wouldn't be doing this show right now.
No, the Earth would be in a deep freeze, and Earth has gone into deep freezes before. We're coming out of one right now. We had a glaciation within the past 10,000 years on Earth, and we're just coming out of the tail end of that right now, where the glaciers are finally melting. And see, instead of global warming, I believe we're just getting back to normal.
Okay, they're all excited about the Project Stardust. Appears to be very successful. Now they have to analyze the dust. What's your take on all of this, James?
Well, first of all, I'm not sure what they have as samples, but my biggest concern, the first thing, is that I don't think they should be bringing this stuff back to Earth. The Genesis space capsule, I'm looking at a picture in front of me here, buried in the Utah desert, and a guy standing over it looking at it with the compartment that held the material they had gathered out there, and he's standing there in plain clothes looking at it. The guys that picked up the Genesis or the Stardust capsule, they're just standing out there in jeans and, you know, kind of a jacket. The Chinese have known for hundreds of years that every time Venus comes around, we get a rash of the flu. In fact, I had a note here to mention that Friday the 13th, this past Friday, was the inferior conjunction of Venus. And I noticed everybody I knew got the flu.
Or some kind of respiratory problem.
Right. And that's what the Chinese have said all along, is that it comes with the inferior conjunction of Venus, implying that Venus has a large, still has a comet tail, which swings around behind it. And we pass through that, and the viruses literally come from space. And this is in the medical literature. So this is not just a wives' tale or whatever. You can find this literally in the literature with tables and charts and graphs and medical records in the that are, you know, the journals of medicine talking about this exact same thing.
Well, do you think this is a pretty dramatic mission?
Any of these, and the unsung heroes here, of course, are the engineers who make all this work. But I look at the claims that, will this tell us how the solar system began, or is this primordial material from the origin of the solar system? I don't know, because there's, say we have, you know, something that hit a planet, 4,000 years ago, or hit something out there, was a collision between a meteorite and one of Jupiter's moons. How do we know that some of this material is not that? And it has nothing to do with the formation of the solar system.
Well, we don't. You know, Richard C. Hoagland, who's going to pop in for a few minutes at the end of this hour just to chat with you, too.
Sure.
He believes this is the Andromeda strain all over again.
Well, yeah, and that's Michael Crichton's book in the 1971 movie that an unknown virus from outer space came in and, of course, was devastating to the human population. That's why they won't even drill in Antarctica to some of these subterranean, like Lake Vostok. Very concerned about even drilling down there because they might expose some bacteria or viruses that have been locked in that ice for thousands of years or whatever. So here we are bringing stuff in from outer space. The clear answer is that's why we need space stations and space laboratories, so that all of that can be handled up there, not bringing it in and smashing it into the Utah desert, and then these guys literally go out with their bare hands and pick it up and put it in a helicopter. Look at all the people that have been exposed to this, including the people in the clean room.
So you don't believe they have done the proper thorough job of at least contaminate because of contamination possibilities?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, there's a lot of scientists who believe that Mars has been contaminated by our probes that have gone there. Both the rovers and the British probe that crashed there, that these were not decontaminated before they went out. So have we contaminated another planet now?
We'll leave this for Hoagland when he calls you. But for you, what's the benefit now of this mission? What are they going to find out, Jim?
I am not sure myself. Let's take best case scenario. It was the primordial material from the comet tail, and they say it's coming off of the comet. I'm saying this is coming into the comet from material that's been floating possibly through the galaxy for, eons. But how do you put this puzzle together? It would be like, let's take an example. You take a pillowcase full of feathers, and you shake it out, and they blow all over the place. Now you go out and pick up all the feathers you can find, and you're getting feathers from birds and all kinds of other, you know, birds that have been living out there. Now you're collecting all this, and you want to say, let's talk about the constituency of the pillowcase with all its feathers in it. It's going to be contaminated. It's going to, you know, how do you make ends meet out of all of this? I guess it's the, I'm not sure if that's a good example, but how do you somehow take all of this material, which may be different in age, different in origin, and say, now we understand how the solar system formed.
Okay, if you are going to design a spacecraft then to go visit a comet and grab some dust, what would you do? How would you design it?
Well, first of all, I would understand that the material is coming into the comet and not leaving it. And that's a whole issue on itself. And we can talk about deep impact here a little later. But so you're gathering material. What I would rather do is, for example, high energy experiments with the electrical currents that are moving around comets, things like that. Some of the comets that probably are most interesting are the ones that are very near the sun that have very intense electrical currents and, you know, for high energy particle physics, that type of thing. Because we know they all have X-rays out to the sunward side, something that was I predicted in 1979 and finally was discovered in 96, actually by mistake. But in fact, that was another one of our possible topics if we get that far tonight, talking about X-rays in the solar system. So I think a lot of fundamental physics is going on around comets, including chemistry, the combination of... What I would like to see is a spacecraft go up and instead of collecting material, have it let go of material, say just different streams of chemicals like oxygen and carbon and nitrogen, and watch these combine in the electric fields around the comet. That would be very interesting.
Well, I've got to tell you, Jim, the possibility of contamination is real. I don't want to take away from the euphoria of the apparent success of the mission, because as Richard will always say, there are some people at NASA who have done a tremendous job there. But you're right, and he's right. I mean, who knows what's out there? And when you begin to bring these things back, you know, what's going to happen? Now, when they brought the moon rocks back, did they take any special precautions for those?
No. No, and there's another good example of the moon rocks. The Luna, Russian Luna unmanned craft brought rocks back, and then we have the Americans brought rocks back. So, but no, not really. But the another point about the moon rocks is a lot of them may have nothing to do with the original moon itself, because of we know from Earth there's a lot of material coming in our atmosphere all the time. And the moon has no atmosphere to break this material up before it hits. So literally the lunar surface is a composite of material that it has collected over the eons. And some of those rocks may have nothing to do with the moon at all. So there again, what are you looking at? What does it really mean? And the contamination problem.
You know, they spotted a meteorite that hit the moon about a month or so ago. I keep wondering if the moon has been shielding us, because that thing could have hit us.
Right, right. Well, it's the moon's surface is a clear record of what's going on out there. I find Mars interesting because if you look at the lowlands on Mars, there's very few craters. But the highlands are cratered almost like the moon. Which tells me that Mars did have an ocean and it eroded away the cratering in that area. But Earth, too, has been pummeled, and we have this thicker atmosphere which breaks up quite a bit of the stuff before it ever hits the ground. But the bigger stuff is going to make it all the way to the ground and put some pretty good-sized holes in the ground.
Well, I got to tell you, Jim, of everything that you have looked at over the past several years, how would you rate this mission compared to other ones that you've monitored?
Well, I thought Deep Impact was a great success, although, once again, they totally misinterpreted the data. The Stardust mission, engineering-wise, was a tremendous feat, and understanding how to shield the collectors, et cetera, was all of the there was a great deal of knowledge that went into that. And as overall, it was a tremendous success. So I have to say that, too. I'm usually too much on the negative side, but I would say it was a very great success. But since nobody ever talks about these other issues, I guess that's what I try and bring up that side of it and concentrate. But, no, Stardust was a tremendously successful mission. It came in at 29,000 miles an hour and hit the ground at 10 miles per hour, so that was a pretty amazing entry, re-entry, and to bring it back and have it land in the Utah desert where they could find it within a few feet, all of that was incredible.
Stay with us. We'll talk a little bit about Deep Impact when we come back. We'll take some fast blast questions, and of course we'll get a quick visit at the end of the hour from science advisor Richard C. Hoagland, who will chat with James McCanny about all things science. I'm George Norrie, back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Let's revisit Deep Impact. 6 months now, probe the data. What's going on with that, James McCanny?
Well, the July 4th, we saw the pictures, and it was a very dry, rocky nucleus. There was nothing coming off of it. There was no snow or ice visible. And the subsequent measurements with spectrometers confirmed that there was no ice or water on the surface. And to be a comet nucleus that would generate the tail material, it would have to look literally like a steam locomotive to provide that much water, carbon monoxide, whatever else is in the tail. It would have to look like a steam engine coming out of ports or off the surface. And these would be tremendously visible, and there was absolutely no visible sign of anything coming off the nucleus. So, and the other thing that's happened since then, and I know Richard Hoagland was emphatic about this, I was jumping up and down about it, they did not release the spectrometer data, and they finally have released that. So, and there again, there's a lot of interpretation. But I think the biggest point about the spectrometer data is that the water and other things that they did see emission lines on was at 1,400 degrees Kelvin. This is superheated material that came out of the collision. And they're trying to compare this somehow to an ice ball that's melting in a solar light that's as weak as a flashlight out where this comet was. So it's really not an apples-to-apples comparison. So the scientists are trying to say, well, this confirms the dirty snowball comet model because they detected water there. Well, it's not the kind of water that you would get from a ice ball. Let's put it that way.
What's the significance, James, if you're correct and comets are not ice balls, but they're harder objects? So what's the significance of that? What does that tell us?
Well, it tells us that first of all, they're not melting away and going away. They're getting, they're building up. But in the case of a lot of these smaller comets, they don't have enough gravitational force to hold the material they're drawing in. So some of it does end up blowing out in the solar wind, and
sure,
that's what fools astronomers. But the significance is then all of a sudden we have the potential for big objects that get much bigger and become planets. Thus, the Velikovsky scenario or the plasma discharge comet model and capture theory of solar system formation, which is what I deal with, that planets and moons of this solar system have been captured. Interestingly enough, last year NASA announced that at least a dozen of the Saturnian small moons have been captured. You know, so we're seeing recent acquisitions all over the solar system. But I want to read one quote here that I found interesting from the spectrometer results. It says, we know there's no water ice on the surface. This is talking about deep impact spectrometer data of the nucleus of Comet Tempel 1. It says, we know there's no water ice on the surface because the surface temperature is too high for there to be any ice. The minimum temperature we saw was about 225 degrees Kelvin, and so ice can't be on the surface unless it's covered in other things. Ice in the outer space sublimes, turns directly from solid to gas at around 200 degrees Kelvin. So then it says, so ice cannot exist on the surface unless it's covered by other things that provide enough thermal insulation, like organics or sooty stuff. And so the idea is that it's, if there is water there, it's protected from any kind of radiation or sunlight from getting into it. Therefore, the dirty snowball comet model is literally dead. It doesn't work. And if it worked, like I say, you would see that nucleus would have to look like a steam engine. And you see all the earlier artwork that NASA put out when they were advertising and promoting these missions, showing the nucleus looking like just jetting these huge jets of water and other chemicals off of the nucleus.
Do you think any of them are ice balls?
Well, there's ice in these objects, clearly.
Sure. So,
and this has come and built up, and it's a conglomerate of materials. So there's water, there's organics, there's hydrocarbons, nitrogen, carbon, oxygen chains, you know, a whole plethora of chemicals that would exist out there, probably up to big organic chains in some, and including possibly viruses that are of unearthly varieties. But the point is that, yeah, these things have built up, and you then have the electron beam coming in from the sunward side that takes this stuff and bakes it into the nucleus. So you have a lot of forces and activities going on around these nuclei. And these are small comets. The big ones, like Hale-Bopp, was actually gathering an atmosphere and water, et cetera. So it was a very dynamic comet and probably left the solar system with a bit of an atmosphere around it.
Would Velikovsky have agreed with you on this theory?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, we're talking the exact same concept. It's just unfortunate that he died in 79. I got to Cornell in 79. And, of course, that was part of my downfall, is I didn't realize the hornet's nest I was walking into, and I start talking about electric comets and that they're not dirty snowballs and that they can become planets, and not realizing where I was and who I was talking to.
They probably said, why did we hire this guy?
Well, one of the reasons is I could teach in multiple languages.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah.
How many languages do you speak?
Well, two very well. And at the time, I was...
English, and what's the other one?
Spanish.
Okay.
And they had foreign students, and that was one of their dilemmas, is they needed someone who could communicate.
Did they ever tell you to stop talking about the things you were talking about?
Oh, absolutely.
Oh, they did?
Oh.
They tried to censor you?
Oh, yeah. I had a woman, her name was Mrs. Richardson, Dr. Richardson, and she literally tailed me the entire time I was remaining in the physics department there. She was with me at all times when I was on campus, literally.
Did she want you out?
Well, no, her job was simply to trail me and make sure that I didn't talk to students about it.
That was her whole function in life there?
Well, when I was there, yeah. Yeah, and then I ended up in the math department after that, and then she was no longer my shadow. But, yeah, that's literally, that's what she did. You know, when I was in a classroom or something, she was there.
You know, Tesla, of course, tried to convince the world that straight from the atmosphere into space would come energy, the ability to create electrical charges. He was on to it. I know he was. They stole his documents when he died and everything he had done. You and Tesla would have gotten along really well.
Right. And that's another thing that came out of my theoretical work was understanding the voltage in the batteries and the ionosphere and how it powers the capacitor that the ionosphere builds, how it drives our storm systems, et cetera. And that's literally what Tesla knew was there, but he didn't understand where it came from or what caused it or what the source of energy was. He just knew it was there, and he knew how to tap into it.
Well, the James McCanny of today is much like the Tesla of old. You're both mavericks. You're both rebels.
And it's kind of strange because he lived alone. Much of my life I've spent alone, and not that I like that, but if people who know me personally know that my lifestyle is something like a mad scientist, partly because I'm so busy.
All right, you'd probably get along with my buddy Dr. Morgus then.
With, papers and piles all over the place, it's hardly like, a normal living situation, but it's the thing you have to be to do all the things that have to be done. There's a tremendous amount of background work that goes on all the time.
Are you happy with the direction your career's taken, Jim?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, I would.
No regrets?
No, I wouldn't have anything any other way. If the only thing I wish was that my work would have been allowed to be published earlier in the scientific journals, and the science community would have taken that direction, because there's so much left to be done.
You know, the work of scientists who are mavericks goes, I think, unknown until one day you stumble into something and you end up winning a Nobel Peace Prize or a Nobel Prize in science.
Well, that's every scientist's dream, I would say. And knowing the history of science, that's another thing is, if you're going to be a science, you better know the history of science. And the one thing, probably the most subtle and interesting discovery I made, is something most people don't even know about in my work. It's called the induced electric dipole redshift. It's a cause of redshift in light from quasars and galactic objects or stellar objects. And you can prove it in a laboratory, which I've done. And oddly enough, as a stigma with all my other work, it's been something that I've been unable to publish.
All right, let's bring in the Coast to Coast Science Advisor to chat with you for a few moments before the top of the hour, Jim. Next hour, we'll open up the phone lines. Richard C. Hoagland, who is he's like a racehorse ready to come out of the chute to talk with you. Go ahead, Richard. Hi.
Good morning, Jim.
Richard, how are you?
I'm pretty good. You know, good. I share with you a lot of the trepidations around, particularly the Stardust mission. The more I look at it, and as I said to George in this audience a couple nights ago, I look over the weekend, I follow this with meticulous attention. I recorded everything, cross-checked things. I mean, this thing has more holes than a piece of Swiss cheese, and I don't mean that scientifically. I mean in terms of the operations procedures. You know, you spend so much money, $212 million, we're told, to bring back these precious grains from the formation of the solar system or interstellar space. There are two classes of grains they were going after. And then you land in the dark on a dry lake bed there in Utah, and you flounder around for an hour with three helicopters because you haven't put $1.50 strobe on your capsule.
You would have that in your model airplane.
Did they have like a GPS device on it?
They claimed to have GPS, but they claimed they weren't able to get closer than a tenth of a mile. Now, I know people that build GPS. There are two versions. There's the civilian GPS, and Jim knows this, and then there's the military version. Presumably, NASA has access to the military version. Again, if you spend all this money and 7 years and 3 billion miles of travel and you've got this priceless cargo, why are you acting like the Keystone Cops?
Yeah, but don't you have to admit, Richard, this appears to be a dramatic mission.
Well, the other night I wasn't able to get to my point because I thought everybody would see the point, but apparently they didn't, so I'll make the point. The only reason you would do this, let me give one more specific. They had the FLIR, the infrared TV, and they had live pictures.
Yeah.
Why didn't we have live pictures in color from the helicopters?
Well, maybe they...
When they're looking
knows?
For the thing?
Who knows?
Well, who knows is not an appropriate response.
Don't ask me. Ask NASA. Don't ask me that.
Well, back when I was with Cronkite, we had live coverage in the middle of nowhere in the South Pacific or the South Atlantic.
Well, you know, they probably figured, you know, it's a unmanned ship. It's a craft. It's going to land in the desert.
They had the entire NASA network on the air for 4 hours, live, across the board. Satellite coverage all over the world. Foreign correspondents, CBS, NBC, major correspondents, major science guys, and no live pictures from the helicopter showing them looking
all right.
for the thing.
I would have if I were running the show.
Yeah.
So would
Bottom
you.
Bottom line, George, here's my point. I think they switch capsules.
Oh,
I think
Richard.
Am I the guy that thinks out of the box on this show, or am I not?
You're thinking, or you got to tell me why you think this.
Okay, because they needed the hour with no one looking to do the switch. Otherwise, none of this makes sense. I mean, there was one live shot from the control center, 10 miles away, line of sight. You could see on the infrared the parachute coming down and touching down on this flat desert between the control center and the mountains, right? Apparently, these guys never heard of a laser designator where you fire a pulse and you get a reflection like a laser radar back.
Yeah.
So you could know within inches where the thing landed on a
right.
bearing. In other words, George, it's the illusion again. It's NASA creating illusions.
Well,
so
all right. Excuse my feeble brain, but why the switch?
Ah, because they can't send to the real scientists, all the honest guys all over the world, the real samples.
Oh.
Because, then don't you think he's howling a bit too much? Because if you're going to maintain the illusion, the model, the money, the investment, the PhDs, the grad students, the whole huge caboose of institutional baggage that comes with the model we've been living with for half a century now. You can't have truth at the 11th hour erupt and have it all blow up in your face.
Well, I got to tell you, when you come up with your theories, you don't hold back.
Well, I'm just asking, something that works like a well-oiled machine, when you've got an hour you can't account for, it's kind of like the missing time on the timelines of who killed Kennedy or Robert Kennedy. When, you know, forensics is a meticulous science where you look at evidence. When you break the evidentiary chain, in other words, when you have to rely on authorities as opposed to the evidence itself, you're in deep trouble.
Richard?
Yes.
I want to interject something here. If this were a court case and some kind of a investigation, let's say, the hand-to-hand passage of this, like you're talking about, simply wasn't there. You couldn't prove in a court case that this is the capsule we're looking at was the one that came down from the sky.
And you couldn't prove this on CSI. That's my point.
Couldn't you? Wouldn't there be some burn marks and stuff like that?
Well,
you can drop another capsule and pick up a damn capsule. We don't know what's in it. Now, Jim made a very important point. On the photos I saw both that night and subsequently, we saw guys with windbreakers and dungarees barehanded.
Picking this thing up
in the desert.
Putting it on a stretcher and hauling it away like it was like a manhole cover.
That's what they did in Roswell.
Then they bring it into this clean room where there are cameras, and suddenly they put on the bunny suits and go through this whole stage malarkey. It's as phony as a $3 bill, gentlemen. And I'm sorry, I'm the skunk at the party, but I got to call it like I see it. And my feeling is, you know, back to what William Henry said earlier, that the real priceless nuggets they got from this mission that we paid for are going into a secret program to be looked at by priests and acolytes who are ritualists. I mean, when this guy Brownlee compared this to a scepter or a magic wand, there is your clue, gentlemen. We're dealing with Masons who have run the program from the beginning, and they will run it till the end. and the American people are not invited except for their dollars.
Very interesting thought, Richard C. EnterpriseMission.com. Richard, when do we talk with you next? What's on your
Well, plan? I'm getting ready, as you know, for the L.A. conference. I'm going to have some astonishing photographs of things that we found on the moon that no one knows exist there, which are artificial. I'm going to blow your mind, George. These photos, I'm looking at one on the screen right now. It is going to blow your mind.
Okay, I'm looking
for it. It's all part of
that.
Our 2012 two presentations on Saturday and Monday.
Excellent. Richard C. Hoagland, EnterpriseMission.com. We'll be back in a moment with Professor James McCanny and your phone calls right here on Coast to Coast AM. We have to talk about this Pluto mission, if they can ever get this rocket ship off the ground, Jim, and then we'll go to calls. This is pretty dramatic, too. They can get it there in 9 years with a huge rocket and a whip-around effect around Jupiter. Isn't that something?
Oh, yeah, amazing. To imagine seeing Pluto, our farthest planet, to understand what is going on out there, and I understand there's a couple new moons that they've discovered around Pluto now. So,
whatever they might be.
Right. But, and then the other possibility is we start to look out farther. And that's like, it's like the Mesopotamians when they first crossed over that mountain ridge for the first time and realized that the firmament was not held up by the mountains. We just start to look out beyond that farthest, what we consider the farthest point in the solar system.
To the phones we go with Professor James McCanny. We'll go to our wild card line. You're on the air with us. Hi there.
Hi there, Doctor. This is George, I can't say last name, George from the Pittsburgh area.
George, go ahead.
Dr. McCanny, you got me excited when you started talking about the water rockets and that. And for history, I talked with a fellow by the name of John R. Searle and a fellow by the name of Dr. Roy Schultz. And Roy Schultz, I was able to get him to do a levitation device using Tesla-like technology and the Browning effect. But in history, because it's so simple, when you studied the ancient past there in the Spanish world, did they have levitation by air balloons or by silver or by their magnetic? Did you discover anything in your and water being a dipolar thing? Even the Germans were able to use that to levitate. Did you discover anything in that past history?
No, actually not. But it's a somewhat of a mystery. Some of the construction of rock cities, especially the Inca ones. Huge rocks, unusual shapes, all fit together perfectly with rounded corners. It just defies any type of modern technology. So something was going on that we don't know about. They do talk about giants living long ago, but these are bigger than any giant could pick up. So, but to answer your question, no, I did not discover any phenomenon or a methodology, say, of levitating or, that's inherent in what I've seen.
Okay. Well, water rockets, I fire off at 4H, and they do go 60 feet with about 60 pounds. Okay. Well, thank you.
Sure.
Okay.
Bye.
Thanks. Appreciate you being on the program. Do you take many speaking engagements, Jim? Do you travel much anymore?
Not much anymore. It takes too much out of my current schedule. And so I've kind of limited that, and once in a great while I may do a public appearance. But what I found out is that I reach far more people on, say, radio or, a show like this. I can reach so many more people, and it's the time to effort ratio, and the number of people reached is much greater. So if I disrupt it, then it takes a while to get everything rolling again.
I get calls from guests who've been on the program before, and the scope of the audience and the magnitude of the 500 station reach, they don't comprehend until after the interview. And then their websites are either cooked or, their books sell and they crawl up from two 100,000th on Amazon.com to number 10. It's pretty dramatic.
Oh, the power of the show is amazing, and I'm so fortunate to be able to be on this show. You know, thank you very much. And to get the message out there to that many people, it is amazing, and I've seen the power of this show and how it works.
So. Well, the thanks comes from us, Jim, because you provide an alternative thought, and I think that's important. It's important to this program to bring different views. And there aren't a lot of them out there that have your views, and, it's refreshing to do that.
Well, good. That really, really works good for both of us.
To the phones we go, east of the Rockies. It's your turn. Hi there.
Hello, this is John from Springfield, Illinois.
Hi, John.
WTAX. I'd like to ask your guest, do you think the weather can be manipulated using those technology that you're talking about?
Oh, absolutely. And we've done some shows on this on Coast to Coast. There are numerous technologies that exist for manipulating weather. The HAARP, of course, was one of the early technologies. The current technology of choice is the laser satellites, which basically drive electrical currents from the ionosphere, and you can move low-pressure cells, things like that.
And what is your idea on the last star that was just, they don't know if it's a planet or not, the 2003 UB313. What's your idea about that?
Which one is that now? I'm trying to think.
That's the one past Pluto. It's like 9 billion miles
okay.
out.
Yeah, that's the one. They don't know if it's another planet or a moon or whatever it is.
Right.
So the number is 2003 UB313, I believe.
Very good.
Yeah, it's hard to say what those are. There's the Kuiper objects, and there's so many post-Neptune objects. You know, dozens and dozens of them now. I think what we were talking about earlier, that they're just starting to discover these objects.
Do you ever, Jim, get into, I really do sound like Bones when I say that. You know? Jim, do you ever get into time travel and theories like that? You know, you are a physicist.
Right, and I have yet to see what I would call proof of that. If you take just, say, moving at half the speed of light, the next star system is not that far away, a number of years. And we spend, like you say, 9 years getting to Pluto if with the proper acceleration. And this is one thing you learn early in physics, is that just a small amount of acceleration. Say, and this is a problem you actually
do. By the way,
do.
11 hours to the moon, that's how fast this thing goes. It took the Apollo group 3 days,
right?
This thing will go past the moon in 11 hours.
Right, yeah.
I mean, boom.
If you accelerate at 32 feet per second, which is our gravitational field, and you just start going in one direction, you accelerate at that velocity, it's amazing how fast you will be going in a week or 2 weeks or a month. And so with that type of, with that thought, interstellar travel is not just with rudimentary Newtonian non-time travel type of scenarios. You can get there within a relatively reasonable amount of time.
What do you think of Richard's theory of the old switcheroo?
There's nobody on the planet that's going to disprove him, and it is a bit odd. Like he said, the best investigation now will not be able to disprove what he's saying. And therein lies the doubt. Can you imagine being one of those scientists really thinking about it and going, you know, do we really have the real stuff here? Are we looking at what we think we're looking at, or are we just being routed down the wrong road? This is what I call Tier 1 and Tier 2 science. Where the Tier 1 scientists get the good stuff and the Tier 2 scientists think they're the top scientists, but they're not.
He's going to be in Los Angeles for a conference on February 10th through the 12th. I'm going to be there. And I just know I'm going to get stuck buying him dinner. I just know it. And with Robin, whom I don't mind buying the dinner for, but he's got to come along. I know he's listening. I'm doing this on purpose. West of the Rockies, you're on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Yeah, Steve in Phoenix.
Hi, Steve. Go ahead.
If one of these large comets comes into the solar system, how reliable is the predicted trajectory of the near-Earth asteroids? And let me explain why it's important. NASA says that on May 10th, 2007, an asteroid named Apollo is going to pass 2 days in front of the Earth, right through the equatorial plane. And when you go to Nostradamus, you repeatedly see May 10th being referred to as the world's greatest earthquake since man has been on the Earth. So is it possible that one of these comets could come up out of the south like Hale-Bopp did and delay this asteroid from getting here by 2 days?
Anything is possible. It's a big empty vacuum out there. Space is a very big place. Collisions are pretty rare amongst the larger things just because there's so few of them. But anything is possible. But
no, I'm talking electrically or gravitationally. Would it be able to alter the speed so it may arrive 2 days late?
Well, perturbations are...
Nostradamus says May is the big date, but they don't say a year.
Right.
And here we are looking at May 8th.
Well, there again, I don't pick dates. I know we've had scenarios where an asteroid was coming very close to Earth's path.
Well, we've got one in 2029 called Apophis, which is the destroyer. That's going to get really close, Jim.
Mm-hmm.
So, and do comets come in the color red? Because I've never heard of a red comet.
Well, it depends on, let's take sulfur dioxide, which is a common chemical around Jupiter, orangish color. So there's many chemicals that could be reddish or orangish that would be accumulated in different parts of the solar system. There's a lot of sulfur dioxide in that Jupiter region out there.
Okay, and the reason I ask that is because of a Hopi legend that I heard since childhood. It says there's two brothers that live south of the South Pole. The blue Kachina and the red Kachina.
Right, and then that's what they're referring to is the, in fact, they actually talked about the blue Kachina being Hale-Bopp, and the red one is yet to
come. The red one's supposed to come within half a generation,
right,
and he's supposed to be the destroyer of worlds.
Right, exactly, and I've heard that also. I've heard that also, but to say specifically a date or could something specifically, say, move the Apollo a minor planet without real data, I couldn't say specifically, but anything is possible. Could it happen? The likelihood is very small, but then again, Earth has been hit by many things, and we've had many objects come by near us, causing what I call action at a distance. So even though it's unlikely, these things do happen.
What do you think about wormwood? What do you think that is, Jim?
Well, it's clear that wormwood, and the place where most people see the term wormwood, besides the herbal catalogs, is the
Revelation.
Is Revelations, the planet of the Old Testament, which was the poisoner of water. That's what wormwood really means. Literally, it means poisoner of water, but it refers to the large planet that wreaked havoc on Earth. And it's interesting, I believe it was Malachi Martin on one of the older Coast to Coast shows, mm-hmm. who said that when the Vatican built its observatory in Arizona, the first one, and they installed a telescope specifically designed to search for comets, and I know some of the astronomers, because they were from the University of Minnesota, they were comet astronomers who staffed that facility when it first opened. Their instructions were to look to see if Hale-Bopp was wormwood. And so that was Father Malachi Martin's statement. But these were all comet scientists staffing a facility which had a telescope designed to search for comets, which is a very, very different telescope than one that was designed to look for galaxies or even planets. A comet is a very large, diffuse structure in the sky. The type of imaging you need is totally different. The type of tracking you need in the telescope is totally different. It's a totally 100% different animal than any other type of telescope. So it's very interesting that the Vatican built a telescope, staffed it with professional astronomers specifically to look for comets.
It's very strange. I mean, you know, a long time ago in a far-off place, maybe, but this strange interest in science all of a sudden, I don't know.
And comets specifically.
Yes. Let's go to east of the Rockies. Your turn. You're on Coast to Coast with us. Hi there.
Hello.
Yeah, take it away.
Yes. It's funny. Richard C. just mentioned that he thinks the capsules were switched. And, George, you just did a report the other day that the moon rocks came up missing.
Yep, in Virginia Beach.
Yeah, what are the chances of that? I mean, if they're grinding them down to maybe make them in the dust, these people to be examining.
Yeah, anything's possible. Did you hear about that, Jim? A NASA instructor had some vials of moon dust, and somebody broke into his van and took them away.
I did not hear about that.
Yep. A couple days ago.
So, now, that would be someone that knew that they were there. That's a totally inside job, sounds like.
Yep, and then what do you do with it? Sell it?
What do you do?
Who would buy that? Some rich guy who has all these art collections and things like that, do you think he'd buy actual moon dust? I bet he would.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. Yeah, that was one of the things I really learned when I was in the Southern Hemisphere during my youth, is the amount of, say, pilfering, and a lot of these artifacts would go into private collections, and people would pay large amounts of money for, say, Mayan or other types of artifacts. So, yeah, anything like that is a collector's item, and there are collectors with money, and they will buy it, and, yeah.
What do you think a vial of moon dust would go for?
I'm not sure. I know I couldn't afford it.
Hundreds of thousands of dollars?
Possibly.
Maybe.
Possibly.
It depends on how much the guy wants it.
But then again, there could be a false market developed very quickly for, you know, moon dust.
Well, you mean somebody would falsify it?
Get a little of that Utah
clay and,
clay and grind it up and, you know, be a going business.
That's very possible, too. Very possible. Jim, we're going to continue with phone calls this hour and chat with you about some of these other things. Interesting theories. We didn't have a lot of time tonight to talk about the sun and its impact on this planet. Are things slowing down up there on the sun, or are they still going to be throwing off these huge coronal mass ejections?
The sun has been relatively quiet for a month or a month and a half. We had some pretty major flaring, impulse flaring going on for a while, and we had those large, large sunspots. And that has somewhat gone away. The sun's been very quiet lately.
Is that a good thing?
Well, maybe a little too quiet. It's hard to say, but we are in the solar minimum, which has been the most unusual solar minimum ever.
It was pretty active up until recently, as you say, and it was a solar minimum during the very active period, right?
Right, right. So predicting the sun has been a risky business. And what it's going to do tomorrow, only the sun knows.
Well, the old saying, the sun will come up tomorrow, Jim.
That's right.
Stay with us. We'll take the rest of your phone calls right here on Coast to Coast AM. I'm George Norrie. Back to the calls, wild card line. You're on the air with the professor on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Yeah, hi, George. This is Ken from Dallas.
Hi, Ken.
Hey, in regards to something that Richard said earlier, we know from past experience that the government has not always told us the truth about things. And if NASA is not telling us the truth about what they're actually finding in space, when are we ever going to know the truth, or is the truth only going to be something for the elite to know, and that the rest of us are just never going to be told the truth about what's out there?
Good question. James, you can take that, and then I'll react to it after that.
Well, I talk about the Tier 1, Tier 2, Tier 3, and even Tier 4 science in the country. The Tier 1 scientists, you never hear their names. You don't know who they are. They have been elevated into these positions. I know personally some that I knew when they were younger, and all of a sudden I can tell who they are, which ones have been taken into Tier 1 science. And I know the guys that are in the Tier 2 science, you know, a lot of them still working at, say, JPL or Goddard and in universities and associated with NASA. And there's a very clear distinction. The Tier 2 guys have no clue that there's this whole layer of science above them. And the Tier 1 guys sometimes mingle with them, and they act like just normal people, but they seriously know that they have been brought into a different group of people with different equipment, with different facilities. They can walk into an observatory anytime they want, and the other guys have to simply leave. A lot of times they're associated with military or black ops programs, and the data gets split in the middle, and the good stuff goes up, and basically what you're talking about is what's fed through the Tier 2 down to the public. A lot of it is just phony science, and these guys don't recognize it. They spend their lives working on actually much of it very good science, but very misdirected science.
You know, the way I look at it, Jim, is, you know, not everything is a conspiracy, but until they prove to us that they're telling us the truth, you have to question everything. And that's the sad part about it. I would love to believe everything they tell us. I would. So would a lot of people, but you just can't. And history has shown to us that they don't tell us the truth on many things. Now, in this particular case with space, you know, Richard has his theories on why he believes they're holding back information. You have yours. You know, I don't know. On one hand, you would think it would be marvelous to tell people, look, we found live organisms out there. It's great. I think that would help increase their budgets. But on the other hand, I can understand the panic and the pandemonium and everything else.
Well, I think it goes much deeper than that, because you have to understand who pays the bill and who the scientists in these organizations work for. And it goes up the ladder to the people who very much control a lot of things in this world. It's a very strange configuration, but to be in Tier 1, once you go in, you don't go back.
That's true. Next up, let's go to our West of the Rockies line. You're on the air with James McCanny. Hi there.
Hello.
Yeah.
Boy, I tell you what, I have tried and tried and tried to get on the air with some of your guests, George, and I'll tell you what, it just drives me crazy when you can't get on and you've got a really good question and want to know what's going on, and you just can't get on the air.
Well, you made it this time.
Well, I'm first-time caller, but not because I haven't tried.
I understand.
I'm a long-time listener. I'm calling from Kalispell, Montana on 1180 KOFI, and I'd like to make a brief comment about that. I've been trying to get these people out here to run your program all together. We get it split up because of prior programming conflicts. We get the last part of your show at between 3 and 5 o'clock in the morning. So sometimes it's kind of puzzling what's going on. It takes a while to understand what the show is about. But anyway, my question for James McKinney, a previous caller in the last half hour mentioned something about controlling the weather, and it just drove me crazy. I didn't think I was going to be able to get through. But do you think that there is the technology to control the weather on hurricanes, which was on a program a while back.
Mm-hmm.
It was brought up.
Had the weatherman, Scott Stevens, remember that?
Yeah, right. Was controlling the weather and could actually control these hurricanes to move into, like, the Gulf of Mexico and just tear that whole country up. What is your view on that?
Absolutely. I have a book that's on my webpage. It's called Principia Meteorologia, The Physics of Sun-Earth Weather, and the title sounds a little bit foreboding, but it's written for the general public. In there, I have a chapter specifically on weather control, but it builds up and explains what really causes weather. For example, hurricanes are not caused by warm water, one of the great myths of modern meteorology. They're really driven by electrical currents from the ionosphere. And when you realize that, if you can influence those electrical currents, then you can influence the hurricane. And there are ways to do that. There are numerous ways to do it. The easiest one is with a laser in orbit above the Earth. And, in fact, you can lead those hurricanes around like a bull with a ring in its nose. So all of that's possible. You can increase the energy. You can break the hurricane up. You can do a lot of things. And I was working on this technology with the Russians back in the 90s. We literally gave it to the U.S. military to drag these hurricanes offshore. But anyway, to make a long story short, yes, there is weather manipulation. It's known. The principles are well known, and there's a lot of misinformation floating around about weather manipulation. And
well, another thing you and Hoagland would agree on, I guess.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, there's no question that it exists. It's there. There have been numerous programs. It went black ops underground, so to speak, back in the, somewhere in the late 90s. Where the current technology and the big laser satellites were launched around the year 2000. So there's no question that it exists.
There was a budget for it at the time. Then they claimed that they ended it, but I'm not sure about that.
Well, but there's budgets and there's budgets.
Yeah, absolutely. First time caller line, it's your turn. You're on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Hi, this is John, driving a big rig up by a farm.
All right, John, welcome to the program. Go ahead, sir.
Thank you. Yeah, I got you on a KEX out of Portland, a 50,000-watt blowtorch.
Oh, yeah, it's a monster.
We get that all the way down to Sacramento. Hey, I got an idea. I agree with Richard on the SWAT, and I was wondering what your guest would think of the Tier 1 scientists wanting to release some information to the Tier 2 scientists, but... And this is the way they can do it. Maybe they got some alien DNA that they can't explain how they got it, when they got it, where they got it, and now they can get it out to the public.
Well, that's a scenario, and I don't know specifically if that would be a real one. There's no question that there are viruses in space. Once you get to the virus level, you're dealing with organisms that can reproduce, and where it goes from there... who knows, but you have to understand it's within the realm of the direction of what these people do. We have underground labs where they deal with viruses, and one of the big areas is space viruses. This has been known for a long time. So there's no question that there's a great interest in black ops and in biology and in microbiology in these organisms. So... I find that to be actually a good match, yes.
Okay, thanks. Appreciate it. Next up, let's go to our wild card line. You're on Coast to Coast with us. Hi there.
Hey, George. It's Andrew calling from Roundup, Montana tonight.
Hi, Andrew.
Good to talk to you again. I'm one of those produce drivers that Sylvia Brown was talking about a couple weeks ago.
Right.
I want to get right to the point here for Jim. You might have saw something that I was curious about on Friday the 13th, the conjuncture we have with Venus. How often does that happen?
Oh, it's about every, I forget what it is. Is it 500 and some days? I can't remember specifically. It takes, our year is 365 days, and then it takes a while for Venus to catch up to us. So it's, I don't have the exact number, I should.
A friend of mine in Seattle came down with flu over that weekend, and he says it happens every couple of years or so, and my back was bothering me on Friday the 13th. It hadn't bothered me for a while.
Well, viruses take many forms, and they can affect you in many ways, but the typical thing is a flu-type dizziness, respiratory. Those are the typical, what the Chinese call... oddly enough, they call it the swine flu, or there's various other names for it. But literally, the implication is that it's from the inferior conjunction of Venus.
Right.
Okay. Thanks, Andrew. Appreciate you being on the program. Clock's ticking. Final calls. We'll go east of the Rockies. You're on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Yes, this is Warren from Greer, South Carolina.
Hi, Warren. How are you?
Pretty good. And thank you for taking my call tonight real quick. I have basically a real quick comment and a real quick question, and it really probably is directed toward Richard Halkin, but I guess I would fall under your Tier 2 research, and there's a lot of areas that I'm sure you're interested in we cover, but my main question has to do with, first off, Hoagland has a hyperdimensional physics, and I just wanted to let him know that I have taken it to a higher level if he wanted to look at my 4D unified map just between him and I and to see what he thinks about it. When we get time, I'll get in contact with him later.
Okay.
My main question to ask him was on the artifacts that he had seen or he's going to, I guess, release on Mars. There's a friend of mine named Ted, who's a researcher at Rochester University in New York, and he's released a book that actually covers all the photographs of NASA's photographs showing in detail these artifacts. And he's tried to present this to your producer, but he's never got a comment back from you all.
Hmm.
And I was just wondering if, you know, check with your producer and maybe get with Hoagland and get with Ted and
okay.
see if they could really have a good show for you.
All right. Sure will.
Okay.
All right. That's it.
Thanks.
Short and sweet. Thanks. Let's go west of the Rockies. Welcome to the show. Hi there.
Hi, this is Juanita Barone calling from Fort Bragg, California.
Hi, Juanita.
Hi. I'm so glad to be able to talk to you and get this out to the public. And many people know already, but I have a friend named Roslyn Peterson in Redwood Valley, California. And she used to work for the Department of Agriculture, and she does not now. But she's had me bring petitions downtown and about the chemtrails. And we have been blitzed tonight. It's just so incredible. Starting again at 12:45 on up till after 1 in the morning, one jet after another, 2 to 3 minutes, they come by here and they're seeding the clouds and causing torrential rains over here. And we've got mold and our bones ache and we don't know what to do anymore.
And it's obvious
it's
you
like
don't
a dictatorship like the reincarnation of Hitler. I just can't believe what this government is doing. I mean, and now they got two bills that are going to be passed. It's 517, and I think that's the Senate bill, and the House bill is 2995. And that's going to add on to the weather modification plan.
Right, right.
Around the world they're doing this. What can we do? I mean, this is sick. No sunshine. People are even telling me they really believe the Bible now and that we are getting close to the end of the world as we know it. Like the quickening. I believe it now.
What do you think, Jim?
Well, there are a lot of people that think that. It's a collective thought, I would say. And my personal belief is that it's amazing the number of, I don't know if you'd call them prophecies or projections, that are all occurring at this time. And it's a critical time in our species as we're trying to step off into outer space and trying to get a handle on what we call government, where the government has taken the resources we've provided to for our self-governance and used them for themselves. So it's a very bizarre situation. My personal read on it is that the populace, it's a kind of an experiment to see if the populace can actually control and govern themselves and control their leaders, because if not, we're not going to get into outer space and nobody's going to let us out there.
Well, that's true, too. Jim, we're rapidly approaching the end of the program. Why don't you give your website out, sir?
It's, of course, linked on the Coast to Coast site. It's www.jmccanneyscience.com. And for listeners who like to use mail, I've got this CD of the four-part Planet X series with the 10-minute clip of Velikovsky and some the tsunami lecture. Anyway, the mail order address is JMCC PO Box 58, Navarre, N-A-V-A-R-R-E, Minnesota 55392. And $28 includes shipping for that CD, and it includes the Surviving Planet X pamphlet for free.
And you've got all that information also on your site?
All on the website there also, absolutely.
Very good. Jim, thanks for being on the program. I appreciate it. Valuable information.
Well, George, it's always great to be able to be on Coast to Coast, and it's my privilege.
All right, you take care. Have a good week.
Thank you.
Professor James McCanny. I love his views. I really do. On our next program, Alex Jones. So get ready for that one. We're going to talk about a number of subjects. All of them affect you. For Steve Carr, Dan Galante, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean LaDesure, Ian Apunnett, and Art Bell. I'm George Norrie, somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM. I'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.